For today's tributaries, we're going to be joining Cultivated Audio for December 2021. Amazing. We're closing out year two of Cultivated Audio and looking forward to all that the new season will bring. We'll begin today with Will Winter. Will has pioneered holistic veterinary medicine since 1980, and since that time has grown brilliantly to look at health for all, from the microbe to the soil to livestock and to us. And also today, Andre Wusny is sharing his philanthropic work in Zambia, assisting the development of livelihoods working with the bees living in the pristine forests within the vast natural Zambian landscape. I'm Robin. Grab your earbuds and or shovel and let's dig in. Will, by 1980, you had created one of the largest and most successful holistic veterinary practices here in the U.S. and co-founded the American Holistic Veterinary Medical Association. Today, you consult and write. Would you fill in my very brief bio telling us about your transition to consultant?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for having me, Robin. This is going to be fun. And, you know, we're all kind of depressed by not getting any good news. And I think pretty much everything I'm feeling now is really good news.
I know, me too.
I'm more than happy to share that light. You know, back to being a holistic veterinarian or a holistic doctor, holistic dentist, nobody goes holistic if they're happy doing what they're doing, right? I wasn't happy with conventional veterinary medicine. I felt like I was maybe doing more harm than good. You know, I had a syringe in each hand and scalpel, and occasionally you have a miracle. And, you know, Western medicine is fabulous for crash medicine. If you get hit by a bus, you don't want a witch doctor. You don't want someone waving herbs over you. You want drugs and surgery, you know. And for that, I felt pretty good. In fact, for a while, I operated an emergency clinic, and that was more successful and more satisfying than conventional veterinary medicine. But I started a holistic practice. I like the word holistic, even though my friends thought I was an idiot for putting the word holistic on the outside of my building. They said, oh, this is like career suicide. People are going to think you are a witch doctor, that you're doing voodoo, because they didn't know what it was. Holistic was pretty scary back in the late 70s, early 80s. But it drew in the right crowd, and I was very successful almost immediately. I mostly knew what I didn't want to do. I didn't know what I wanted to do. At that time, I had not become advanced in acupuncture, herbal medicine, chiropractic, homeopathy, the very alternative modes that I slowly and painfully learned through internships and travel and study. But it was like learning Mandarin Chinese when you've never studied any foreign language. It was an uphill grind. And then I work with veterinary students who are still in the harness in school, and they want to learn holistic medicine. I said, are you crazy? You have to learn standard medicine first. And first of all, you'll get your head chopped off if you tell the instructor that you might know something they don't know or they don't teach, because they'll tell the vet students, well, if it was any good, we would be teaching it to you. So therefore, shut up.
Right.
And any practitioner that embarks on a holistic career is putting their whole career in jeopardy, because if the patient dies, God forbid, and you had done all the antibiotics and surgery and all that, well, then obviously it was God's will. It couldn't be saved. We did everything. However, if you eschewed all of those things and were waving your magic herbs over the patient or doing a very legitimate job of holistic medicine and the patient dies, well, then you're dead, because everyone knows if you just used the antibiotics, they would have survived. So that's the challenge to a holistic practice. I wasn't happy. I wasn't feeling like I was doing the patients any good or the clients. I've never looked back on that decision. So then there was a transition that came in 1999 where I felt like I could fix every poodle and every pussycat in America, and there would still be major problems. And I felt like there's billions of animals suffering in feedlots and confinement operations, sow gestation crates, chickens in a cage. And I thought, I got to break out of my comfortable milieu here of being this holistic guy, and I've got to go out and help these animals. And I feel like I've done a lot of karmic damage as a veterinary student and as a veterinarian. I worked in the research labs for many years at my alma mater, and I shudder. I have nightmares about some of the animal research that I was a part of as a unwitting, I guess, just I didn't know any better. How's that? And I'm not a vegetarian. I was for 23 years. I was a vegetarian. And during that period, I became a humane vegetarian in that I didn't know there were actually humane rearing techniques for livestock. And I kind of ran out of bullets as a vegetarian. I didn't have the chutzpah. I didn't have the strength, the grit to run a large practice with four or five veterinarians, 20 employees, and the clients beating down the door every day. And I knew I was losing my grit. And when I first had a fillet of, I think it was tuna or salmon, I could feel my strength coming back. And then now we eat pork, we eat beef, we eat chicken. We have access to all of these sources of incredible, delicious, humanely reared, nutrient-dense meats, eggs, and dairy. I feel proud to be part of that transition to that. So my job now as a consultant is to help people get there. And my specialty is to take someone who they want to raise animals, or maybe they're a farmer already and they're not making any money. They're going broke. Farmers are going broke from coast to coast in America. It's a horrible feeling to work 12, 14-hour days beating your brains out and baking your brains out and working with dangerous equipment and still not making a living to feed your family. So we can get these people going and we can clip years, 5-10 years off their learning curve to learn how to raise whatever they want to raise. If they like pigs or if they don't like pigs, if they like sheep, if they like goats, if they like chickens, raise what you love, because it's a very important part of this to be in love with the animals on your farm. And you'll resonate better with them. You won't be cruel to them. You'll have a happier life if you convert to something that you love. And then just let us help you with the technical parts of how to get there. So I feel like I'm at the top of my game. You know, most people my age are either dead or they're playing golf or they're, you know, watching television. And I'm not any of those things yet. So I like doing what you're doing here with this show. There may be someone out there listening who is ready for a change in their life. And I hope there are. I hope that people hear this and it inspires them, whatever their age, doesn't matter.
Exactly.
To be a part of this revolution.
Yes, any one of us can start with 5 chickens. It doesn't have to be a huge ranch or farm. And I know that's kind of your MO. That's who you work with. And as we go on today, you're going to be able to share with people whether they are a large landowner or a backyard gardener. There are so many facets to all of it that really work, whether you're one or the other. I believe I read in one of your articles you used the word evangelical about how some people start talking about apple cider vinegar. And now you've become quite an expert on its use for livestock as a rumen and immune tonic. How did you get started?
You're a very good question person because you evoke memories. And I remember when I was a little kid, my mother had a book and it was by D.C. Jarvis. He was a Vermont folk doctor, an MD, in the 20s and 30s. And he wrote this book, I think it was in the 30s or 40s, something about health. This guy believed you could cure just about anything with apple cider vinegar and raw honey. So he would mix up this drink that he calls switchel. And you take maybe a tablespoon of raw apple cider vinegar, not the distilled vinegar, not the white vinegar. This has to be from apples. So you take this live vinegar, you mix it with honey to your taste, and just sip it. And my dad did this. My dad was kind of a farm guy, and he had terrible heartburn. He had GERD. He had acid reflux. And my mom got this book, and he read it, and he drank apple cider vinegar the rest of his life, and he never had that heartburn. So I knew that. And then also, we grew up in a wheat raising family. And one of the things you do with winter wheat, you plant it in the fall. It comes up. It looks like a beautiful yard. It's this beautiful green grass, about a foot tall. And we graze our cattle on it in the winter. And this plant needs that. And then you take them off in the spring, and it pops out of the, into the wheat plant that we harvest the wheat. And then you do it all again. But when we put our cattle on that wheat, it was very bloaty. I can't tell you how many animals I saw laying on their side, their tongue hanging out, and their stomach is just sticking up 3 feet in the air. They're bloated, and they're dying, basically. My uncles knew this, that if we took a Coke bottle full of apple cider vinegar and glugged it down their throat, either with a stomach tube, or usually we didn't have a stomach tube, we just poured it down the side of their mouth. Within minutes, they would leap up, they would start burping the gas out, and they were grazing in a half an hour to an hour and perfectly normal. And that was the only thing we ever knew about it. So I go to college, I get a degree in ag, I get a degree in veterinary medicine. The number of times people mention apple cider vinegar was zero.
Right.
And here's this great learning tool that I didn't know about. And the only thing I knew about it was to give it to a sick animal or a sick human. And this Dr. Jarvis's book was fabulous. I think, oh, I know the title. It was called Folk Medicine by Dr. D.C. Jarvis, still in print. I bet he had 100 different things like arthritis, hives, allergies, migraines, all these things you could do with apple cider vinegar. And this was in the back of my mind. So I meet Steve Campbell, who is a bovine geneticist, and he teaches people how to pick the right cattle for grass finishing. But he told me about Roger Fairchild out in Fruitland, Idaho. And this guy was making a real apple cider vinegar, and he had patented a technique of a certain way to grind the whole apple up. And you made apple cider vinegar out of the whole apple, because everybody that's made apple cider or apple cider vinegar, the first thing you do is squish the apples in a press, apple press, throw away the apple and keep the juice. Well, Roger said, no. He said the real medicine's in the skins and in the meat of the apple and even the core. He never pasteurizes it, never heats it, because it's the living bugs that make it work. This guy knew all this, and he's not a doctor, but he is kind of a doctor, because he knows how to get medicine out of plants. And I don't know if there's any better definition of a doctor than somebody that does that. And all the other people that make apple cider vinegar in the country use a juice or a juice concentrate. Now, if you have a juice concentrate, that means you've boiled it down and you've killed the microbes. And not only have you killed the microbes, you've killed the enzymes. So we found out that what does the heavy lifting is not the acetic acid in it, the vinegar. It's actually the microbes and the enzymes. And those enzymes are used over and over and over again. So what we started doing is using the apple cider vinegar first as a tonic when we had sick animals from shipping. It's called shipping fever, or if they're bloated, or if they're having scours, diarrhea, if they're having even pneumonia. It was like this great medicine is pennies a day. And you can eliminate so much in that. Well, then we had this phenomenon happen. We had some cattle that we put up on the south shore of Lake Superior in northern Wisconsin. This was through the guy that owns the place where I work. And the herdsman called and he said, I think this vinegar is making your cows sick. And he said, what? He said, yeah. He said, they're not eating. He said, I normally put 4 or 5 bales of hay out there for them. This was in the winter. And now they're only eating 3 bales. So they're off of their feed. And the owner said, well, are they getting skinny? Are they losing weight? And he said, well, that's a funny thing. They're just getting fat as little butterballs. So we're adding 2 and 2, and we're going, wait a minute, they're eating less and they're gaining more? Yeah. Well, how could that be? Well, it took us 10 years to figure this out. But the scientific part is that this live vinegar stimulates the cellulosic bacteria in the rumen. It's wood. And now humans can't digest wood. Pigs can't digest wood. Chickens can't digest wood because we don't have this rumen where these magic bugs live. And they break down cellulose into sugar. And it is a sugar because any chemical word that ends in O-S-E is a sugar. It's just a long chain hydrocarbon that we are unable to break down into the simple sugars that we can use for energy. Vinegar is stimulating the bugs to break down the wood and the hard part. Anybody can digest sugar or starch. And that's in grasses, it's in grain. Grain has starch, grass has sugar. And there's a difference that we can talk about later, why you should always eat grass-fed beef if you can, because it's got the right kind of fats made from these sugars instead of the wrong kind of fat made from the starch. Point of the story is the healing medicine that you get from the vinegar is a free bonus. But the reason people are using vinegar now is that it saves them so much money.
Right. Always, right.
You have less feed. You can increase your stocking density. If you have 1 acre of land, you can put two animals on it instead of one, and they'll do fine. It's actually a money-saving device. It helps them digest their food. And money is kind of the story of farming. You have to make money or you're not going to be around. Doesn't matter how organic you are or holistic you are. If you're not making money, you're going to be gone. You're going to be back in town. So this has been a godsend. And I believe I'm hooking people up with somewhere around 6,000 to 7,000 gallons of vinegar a week across the country. And it's just begun. People are skeptical, and farmers are double skeptical. They've all had the next guy driving up the driveway has got the miracle. This is going to solve your problems. So they're tired of hearing miracle worker.
Yes, and aren't then, we all?
You know, so when you actually have something that does work for everybody, it's almost embarrassing. And what I want to do is like, tell you what, I'm going to give you a barrel free, because it's that first barrel or the first tote or the first drink that is the hardest for them to accept. And then they will see the results. The other exception to that seeing results is that I work with a lot of ranchers out west, out in Montana, Idaho, Oregon, Wyoming, and they don't measure anything. And if you don't measure anything, you won't know whether something worked or not. The best farmers in terms of measuring are dairy farmers, because every day they see how many gallons are in the bulk tank. So if you change something and there's more milk in the bulk tank, aha, they know in one day whether it worked or not. And then just by nature, dairy farmers, they touch their cattle every day, except some of the robotic dairies. And they listen to their cattle. They look at their ears. They look at their eyes. They look at their hide. They look at their manure. They know whether their cattle are getting off. I'm generalizing here, but a typical rancher will drive his pickup across. Oh, there's a dead one out there. Legs are sticking up. Wonder what happened. Oh, well, and they may not even do an autopsy to see what happened, which I always do. I can't stand to lose an animal. And not
well, of
know
course
why.
You do. Yes, it's you hate to
yeah.
see it, of course.
But even my profession, and you'll gather throughout this that I kind of hate my profession. I do. I love working with animals. I'm grateful for the education I got to help animals. But my profession is involved with a lot of chicanery, whether it's working on rodeos or laboratory animals right. or farm animals. We couldn't have feedlots if it wasn't for my profession, because if you yanked away all their drugs, they would all die. The only reason you can jam them all together in a concentration camp like that is because they're all on antibiotics every day of their life. Right. And that is a prescription that comes from my profession. So my profession could clean up so much animal abuse if we just cared about animals like we said we do.
Yes, and another measurement certainly is the increase in butterfat that you speak about for the milk. And another place I know is the somatic cell count problems that some dairy farmers have. Can you describe how the ACV has helped that situation?
Yeah, I sure can. And again, we're exploring this. We're finding it out just like you guys are. No one told us all this. There's no book. We didn't know it was as good as it is because nobody told us. So I get this call from an organic dairy out in Idaho, and 1,200 cow dairy, which nowadays is not a big dairy. There's 20,000 cow dairies, which is gross. But anyway, they were having somatic cell count problems. And what that means is that the number of white blood cells or pus in the milk was too high. There's a limit set by the government of how much pus you can have in milk. I know I'm grossing a lot.
Thank goodness.
But it's just a reality. And actually, they're the good guys. The white blood cells are the fighters. They're the ones that kill germs. They kill pathogens. So you actually want white blood cells in your milk to kill the salmonella, listeria, E. coli. All of the deadly pathogens can be destroyed by natural white blood cells in the milk. But if you have too many, that means you have mastitis, which is an infection of the udder. And these commercial dairy cows are banging out so much milk. They're on these hot rations that they only live about 42 months average in a commercial dairy, which is ridiculous. A good Amish dairy, they'll have teenage cows that they know by name, and they come in every day. They know the drill. They bang out a calf every year, and it's grease grooves. But the commercial dairies, it's a torture chamber all from beginning to end. Again, I'm generalizing. I'm not saying they're all that way, but it leans that direction. So this dairy called me and they said, what you got? I always hate this because the pharmaceutical industry has given us a model of like you throw a drug at a problem. Oh, my God, you got smallpox. You need this. Oh, my God, you got TB. You need this. Rather than, well, why do they have TB? Why do they have brucellosis? Why do they have mastitis? So I got into all of that. Well, why do they have mastitis? Well, they didn't want to hear that. They were very conventional. It's like, don't you have something? And finally, they gave me the ultimatum. They said, well, if you only did one thing, what would you do? Oh, I hate that. But anyway, I said, oh, well, that's easy. I would give them apple cider vinegar. So this is a big dairy. They bought 5 totes of vinegar. A tote is 275 gallons. And I, as predicted, I never heard from them again. This was like in May. And out of the blue in August, this guy calls me and he said, hey, are you the vinegar guy? And I said, well, no, I'm not the vinegar guy, but I'm the guy that sent you guys some. He had identified himself. And he said, well, we want to know what the biggest container of vinegar you can get is. And I just bust out laughing. So I said, so it knocked out your somatic cell count and mastitis, eh? And he said, he said, I don't know much about that. He said, I don't know which end of a cow you put hay in. I'm an accountant. I'm the bean counter. And he said, when we started giving your vinegar, our butter fat shot up from 3.1 to 3.9. And we get paid on protein and fat in the milk, not volume. You could throw a garden hose in and increase volume, but you can't increase fat or protein artificially. So he said, we love that. We're making almost 25% more money on our milk. And he said, so he went out and talked to the herdsman and he said, was that vinegar that did that? And the herdsman said, nah, it just couldn't be vinegar. I was just giving them 4 ounces per head per day. So nothing works that good. So they quit giving it. Well, sure enough, within 2 or 3 weeks, that butterfat was banged down right where it had been before. So they started giving it again. Well, that dairy is very happy. It's an organic dairy. They're hurting by the semi-load now. And they will never quit giving vinegar. And that's a universal thing. What I've found is anybody that's tried apple cider vinegar for whether it's chickens, pigs, horses, doesn't matter. They will never quit giving it. But once they see the coat slick up, once they see the parasites go away, the flies, the worms, the lice.
The flies was interesting to me, learning about that the flies go away after.
Yeah, and I'm not saying it's a silver bullet for flies. You still have to have good manure management. The nasty flies breed in manure. And if you got cattle staying around in manure all the time, not even a feedlot, if you're not moving your cattle around or your sheep or your goats, they will have flies. And they also have worms because the eggs come out in the poop. It turns into a larvae and they crawl up on the grass. Well, they can only crawl up about 2 inches. So if you overgraze your pasture, the animals are going to eat those worm larvae, and they're just never going to break that cycle. Now, the buffalo figured it out. They migrate. In fact, buffalo walk while they graze. And when they go to sleep at night, they're maybe 5 to 10 miles from where they were yesterday. So the animals never eat those eggs, so they never were plagued by parasites or flies. And in fact, buffalo hate flies, and that was one of the major causes of a buffalo stampede, is that they got flies on them. They would just run 40 miles an hour, 10 miles, and they don't have any flies anymore. The flies couldn't keep up with them.
Perfect.
Yeah, so nature has all these answers. And what we're doing in holistic medicine, as you might guess, is we're mimicking Mother Nature.
Right.
There's your answer.
Yes. Yeah. Now, Will, what about us? I know that you had a very natural transition into learning so much about human health, of course, as you moved along. And I'm already convinced it will help humans with gut problems taking apple cider vinegar. Can you expound on that just a little bit before we move on to our next topic?
You know, it doesn't taste good. I personally don't like the taste of apple cider vinegar myself. But when I put enough raw honey in it, it's a delicious beverage. And you can buy Switchel now in a lot of supermarkets, co-ops, natural food stores, Switchel, which is vinegar and honey. And it's a really a great health drink. And it's one of the primal ways to get your gut biome back into health. And almost every autoimmune condition, almost every chronic ailment, pain, arthritis, dementia, allergies comes from a disrupted gut biome. So vinegar will straighten it out. You know, Hippocrates, the father of Western medicine, they don't listen to him anymore, but he said all disease begins in the gut.
Yes.
And he's right.
Yeah.
All chronic disease. Mm-hmm. So they knew, if they knew that 5,000 years ago or 2,000 years ago, why don't they do it now? Well, there's no money in that.
Of course.
The money is wait till you get sick and then I've got the magic juice for you. Probably. So I would say start with a tablespoon of vinegar and then put maybe a teaspoon or two of honey in it. Stir it up really good and sip it. You don't have to gluck it down. Just enjoy it. Things work better if you enjoy it than if you're holding your nose and,
right, yes.
You know what I mean? That's true of all healing techniques. You got to feel good about it. That's all you need. Just a tablespoon a day will change your life, and it makes you feel good, especially if somebody has acid reflux. I'm experimenting with intermittent fasting, which means I don't eat until noon. You can also do it the other way, not eat after. But I don't eat until noon, and then I eat for about 6 hours on and off, you know, lunch and dinner. And then at about 7 o'clock, I stop eating and don't eat anything 2 or 3 hours before bedtime. Boy, I can't say I love it because I'm a breakfast guy. I love breakfast. But it's working for me, and you got to go with what makes you feel better, look better.
All right, well, let's switch gears.
Okay.
And the gear we're going to, earlier you had told me you would like to share for the backyard gardener and the large commercial farmers and ranchers how to get glyphosate out of your land and animals. And off mic, you spoke about biological products containing powerful microbes that can literally eat glyphosate and other hydrocarbon herbicides. What else have you got for us?
Glyphosate, for people that don't know, is a patented drug that was patented by Monsanto originally. It's been sold to Bayer, the biggest drug company in the world is in Germany. They own the patent for it now, and I think it's off patent, so there's generic glyphosate. But it's a prime ingredient in Roundup, and there's a lot of adjuvants and other chemicals in Roundup. There's 50 different brand names, but if they have the glyphosate, they usually have things that activate it or combine with it. Because what has happened, as happens in nature, if you keep hammering away at a species that you don't like, say a weed in this case, the weed is smart enough to figure out a mutant version that is resistant to your products. So we have these super weeds, they're called, or in hospitals, we have super bugs that you can't kill with antibiotics, or we have super bugs. You have insects that can't be killed normally. And if you talk to almost any farmer into hate weeds, hate flies, hate worms. And the reason that is the industries have created a fear factor, and they put the boogeyman fear into you. They're doing it right now with the pandemic, of course, is the boogeyman's going to get you if you don't have your drugs. But with the weeds, farmers feel helpless. Like, I don't want to use glyphosate. There's hardly a farmer I've ever talked to that says, I don't want to use it, but if I don't, I'll go broke. Of course, the answer to that is not a simple silver bullet, like just use this. Although for the homeowner or the gardener, it's real easy to make a weed killer that is natural and harmless. And all you have to do is take cheap vinegar, like the white distilled vinegar that we don't drink ourselves or give to livestock, but it's just cheap vinegar. It's pennies. In a gallon of vinegar, put a cup of either salt or Epsom salts and a couple tablespoons of liquid dish soap. Stir it up. Whatever you spray it on is going to die. In your garden, you have to be selective in what you're spraying it on. But if you have grass growing up in the cracks of your driveway or your sidewalk, oh boy, is that good. And especially if you put it on in the heat of the day when the sun is on the plant. By the time you get done, it's already shriveling up, and the next day it's croaked. And certain weeds that have long roots, perennial weeds or tree shrubs, things like that, you might have to do it 2 or 3 times. That is a really good antidote to feeling forced to use this. One of the things farmers still use it for, in addition to their driveway, is their fence lines, because electric fences will short out if you have weeds under the fence line and cattle can't get to the other side of the fence very easily. So the weeds grow up. So with that, we either mow it, have them mow it, or have them get some goats. And I say that with a chuckle because I have goats. And you have to be a little bit insane to have goats. They are naughty. I have hair sheep. And hair sheep, they try to be nice every day. They try to do the right thing. Just the exact opposite of what a goat does. But goats are weed munchers. They don't like grass. They'll eat it if they have to, but they like weeds. So one of the other tricks we use in holistic management is multi-species grazing. After the cattle have gone through there, we'll either run some sheep or some goats on the same pasture because the parasites are different. A cattle worm won't grow up in a goat or a sheep, and a sheep worm won't grow up in cattle. So it's a dead-end host. And those larvae think, oh boy, I've been swallowed by a ruminant. Oops. And then they die. In fact, a funny story, I work with a lot of goat milk dairies, and there's a lot of people that are allergic, or at least think they're allergic to cow milk. And goat milk is closer to human milk anyway, so goat milk is delicious and good if it's done properly. But we'll have somebody start a goat dairy, and their health is fine, don't need any help. Second year, goats are fine. Well, there's a couple sick ones. Third year, the wheels come off, and everything falls apart. What's happened is that the goats have cleaned up all the weeds and there's nothing left but grass. And grass is frequently an annual plant with very little medicine in it.
Right.
The weeds are frequently taproot plants that subsoil. They go down below the worn out soil.
Yes.
And they bring up rich nutrients,
right,
and all these polyphenolic compounds that are in plants that are actually medicine.
You
know, people now know about resveratrol and lycopene and lutein. These are all plant metabolites. There's tens of thousands of them, but the weeds are loaded with it. In fact, a lot of weeds are natural wormers. They're natural fly repellents. They're natural antibiotics, and they're natural vaccines. And it's all in those weeds. So about the third year you have goats, your farm looks like a golf course. This is a beautiful grass everywhere, not a weed in sight, and your goats are sick. So with goats, we have to always figure out ways how to create a creative, multi-species, biodiverse grazing paddock for them. And we have cocktails of different plants. One of the things that is a hallmark of natural farming is biodiversity. And the hallmark of commodity, commercial, industrial farming is monoculture. Nature abhors a vacuum. It doesn't like bare soil. That's the worst. And most weeds are covering bare soil. They're like a Band-Aid over bare soil or sick soil. And weeds are here to help us, by the way. If people are plagued with thistles or multiflora rose or leafy spurge, you know, these invasive plants that have no natural enemies on when they got here, so they're taking over, that means somebody has abused your soil. And the plants are indicators. You can buy books from Acres USA, the largest eco-agriculture bookstore in the world. If they don't have it, you don't need it.
Right.
But they have books about indicator plants. And so you look up what weed you're hating, and it will tell you what's missing or in excess in your soil. And you fix that, and magic, weeds just went away.
Right.
They do.
Yes.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah. Just to go back for a moment, I can see it would be easy for a backyard farmer or a backyard gardener, rather, or someone to use this recipe you gave us on their driveway. How are the ranchers using this on their big farms? Is it just basically it is a very labor-intensive process?
Yeah, you're very perceptive. You're right. You wouldn't be out there with your little backpack sprayer spraying a 100,000-acre ranch.
Right.
You know, it would be impractical, idiotic. Your neighbors already probably think you're a lunatic if you're doing grass farming anyway.
Yeah.
That's what people in, you know, I live in corn and bean country, they call it, you know, and even the ranchers here in the Midwest, they call it, when they say corn ground, they don't say corn ground. They go, oh, that's corn ground. You know, in other words, that's the king of all the crops. And if you're not growing corn on your corn ground, you're a failure. So they'll see grass out there and go, oh, that schmuck doesn't know how to raise corn, you know? So anyway, so we fight that. But here's the deal. It's about management. What we do is called mob and move grazing. There's a bunch of different names for it.
We've learned about that on Cultivated Audio from various folks. Yes.
Right. So we mimic Mother Nature again.
Mm-hmm.
So let's say you have one cow and 1 acre, and you let that cow graze for 250, 300 days. And she can wander around anywhere she wants. What's she going to eat? She's going to ice cream eat, we call it. She's going to go to the candy grass. She's going to go to the delicious grass and munch all of that out of there. Then when she's got it all munched out, it's starting to grow back, and she's going to go nibble it again, those same plants, which, by the way, kills it. And what she's going to eat last are the weeds, the stuff that don't taste quite as good. Not even a weed, just grasses that don't taste quite as good. Reed canary grass, fescue, some of the grasses that just aren't as yummy and delicious and soft and tender and sweet. So she's going to keep doing that. So what do you end up with after 2 or 3 years of what we call set stock grazing? You end up with a whole bunch of weeds. So it's a management problem. It's not a weed problem. It's a management problem. It's a farm problem. So what we do is we mimic the buffalo. Let's say you have one cow, 1 acre. You give her 1/4 of it or 1/5 of it or 1/10 of it. And we use electric fencing for that. And she goes around like a vacuum cleaner, like, oh, that's good. That's good. I'm going to eat that. Oh, heck, that's not as good. I'm going to eat that too. Oh, I don't have anything left. We let them take it down to a certain percentage. And then we open the fence and she gets number two. She goes into paddock number two. And then if we've divided our land properly, and if we've had a rain, by the time she gets back to number one, it's all regrown. It's all pretty again. It's all even. And she gets to start all over again. Well, the grass loves this. This is called pulsing, where we take it down. The grass releases a bunch of plant exudates from the root ball to stimulate the soil, to break down the soil, release some nutrients, and jumps up again. Plants love that. And they munch it off again. Oh, we're going to release. And again, you have to have a proper rest period. You can't do this without the rest period. It's kind of like the 7 Habits of Highly Effective People. In that book, it's called Sharpening the Saw. And he said, I don't care what kind of executive you are. If you don't take a rest period, even God took a day off, you're going to end with a dull saw. And he used the analogy of a guy is sawing wood, sweat pouring off of him. He sawed for about 2 hours. And he sawed about 1/4 of an inch. And the observer says, well, you know, if you should stop and sharpen your saw is all dull. No, I don't have time, the guy says. So he's sawing away, working himself to death. So the pastor needs that rest period too. And this is the antidote to weed problems. You will never have weed problems. Where I grew up in Kansas, we're the last remnant of what's called the tall grass prairie. And it was a stripe from Canada to virtually Mexico, Texas. We're over the rain shadow of the Rocky Mountains. And we have this tall grass prairie. When the settlers, our ancestors, saw it, they were terrified. It looked like an ocean to them. They couldn't see one tree. And that was land that was incidentally managed by the Native Americans. They managed America like this huge Garden of Eden. Mm-hmm. The book 1491 by Charles Mann talks about what was here when we got here. It was heaven. They figured out ways to control fire, move the buffalo around. And the buffalo did move around. That's why there's a buffalo in New York. And, you know, there's all mm-hmm. of these areas where buffalo migrated 3,000 to 4,000 miles every year, following the fertility and looking for mineral licks and salt licks. So again, that moving mob. And bison stayed together. Why did they graze so close together? Not because they liked each other. Predators, wolves, things that would kill our babies when they were all mobbed together. And our cattle have lost that instinct. So they're like, guess I'll go graze over there.
Right.
And, you know, they don't have that instinct. And we kind of don't either. There's a funny story about if you walk into a movie theater and it's empty and there's one guy sitting in the middle of the theater all by himself, you're going to sit somewhere else, right? Mm-hmm. So they say, okay, you walk into the theater, they turn off the lights and they unleash a hungry lion. Where do you sit?
Right.
You're sit right next to that guy, you know. The old guy putting on his track shoes when they're attacked by a mountain lion. He said, what are you doing? You can't outrun a lion. He said, I just have to outrun you.
Exactly.
Andre, you are a regenerative farmer in Boulder, Colorado, but today we're going to be focusing on your philanthropic work with the people and the bees in Zambia, Africa. Briefly, how did you end up there working and helping these people to develop their livelihoods working with the bees?
I first started working in Zambia through NGO development work, which I was doing all over Africa in my early 20s. I just had this growing sense that the nonprofits weren't really making the kind of impact that I thought was the most important, because by their nature, they have to really focus their work on the neediest people and the areas of greatest need. And what I felt was being neglected was the areas of greatest potential. And so when I was just traveling around and exposed to this community in Zambia, in the northwestern part of Zambia, I just found a group of people. They had an household income of about $75 annually. So that sounds very bad, but at the same time, they had capability and they were beekeepers. And I connected with them on the level of their beekeeping because I had started keeping bees here in Boulder when I was in grade school. And so that's the relationship that started based around that thing that we had in common and the observation that they were actually really good at keeping bees. I learned so many things about keeping bees from them that I had never heard of or read in any book.
Can you share a couple of those things you learned?
Yeah, sure. Well, one thing that I've never really heard American beekeepers talk about, or I hadn't before, and since then I've talked to some of them and they get what I'm talking about, but is listening to bees. So most of the beekeeping that I was taught was very visual. So we look at the comb, we identify the different kinds of comb, some that are for storing pollen, some for storing nectar, which is being turned into honey, other areas of comb for brood, where the babies are being reared. And we can tell a lot by looking at the comb, what's going on in that part of the hive, and then also visually looking for the queen. But Zambians, the traditional hives that they use don't have removable frames. If you were to try to look into the hive, you would destroy it. So they were laughing at me because when I was helping them harvest, I wasn't very good at identifying where the brood was going to be because I was used to looking for that. Whereas they would laugh at me, "Can't you hear that that's where the brood is?" And I said, "No, I can't. How am I supposed to hear where the brood is?" And eventually I learned to listen for it. And there's a lot of other things that you can learn by listening to the bees instead of just using your eyes.
So you've already begun for us here a verbal picture of the beekeepers over in Zambia and what you're learning from them. They're beekeepers, and yet are they working in a more natural setting with the bees being in these forests?
That's right, yeah. So the bees in Zambia, the primary nectar sources for the bees are trees. They're these leguminous tree species in a kind of forest called the Myombo Forest. And it's as significant to the world's oxygen cycle as the Amazonian rainforest, and yet we're not generally familiar with the Myombo Forest. But the best species of trees to produce nectar are the ones that are found deep in the forest, far from human settlement. And so these beekeepers will hike far into the forest and then set up a camp. And from there, they maintain bee colonies along trails. The Western model is you have all your bees in an apiary, which would be like a fence around, 15 or 20 or 35 or 50 colonies. But African bees are more defensive of their colonies than European-type bees. And so it's too dangerous to keep too many colonies close together, because when one colony starts to get excited, then all the colonies start to get excited, and it can be quite scary. So the way that African beekeepers in the Myombo Forest work is they set up a camp, and then they'll have four or five different trails that extend way out into the forest, and every 300 or 400 meters along the trail, they'll pick a tree, they'll climb way up into the tree, and hang a beehive and maintain it up at an average height of 25 to 30 feet. And so if you're walking through the forest and you don't know they're there, you would never know. You can't see them. But that keeps the bees safe from honey badgers, which are a threat to bees. And it actually turns out that even American bees prefer to be in colonies way up off the ground. But for the most part, we don't do that here for our own convenience. Here in Colorado, we just don't have as many trees. that are big enough to support that kind of colony. So I continue to have my bees closer to the ground, but I've toyed with the idea of building a platform way up high for bees. They like to travel up there. And usually if you watch bees exiting a hive, they will climb for some distance before they have a cruising altitude, which is about at that height, 20 to 30 feet above the ground.
What properties do the two primary tree sources give to this honey and or their wax?
Well, there are different honey flows in different times of the year because the different leguminous trees flower at different times. And there may be many unresearched medicinal properties. We're members, actually founding members of the Ethnobotanical Society of Zambia, where we're trying to collect information from all the different indigenous peoples of Zambia in terms of what are the uses of different plants and different honeys. But we can certainly know from the taste that they're really distinct. The two honeys are called Muchesa and Msasa, which is kind of confusing because they sound similar, but that's in the Lunda language. One of them, Msasa, the honey flows in January. It's very dark colored honey. It's high in fructose. All honeys have some fructose and some glucose, depending on the flowers that the nectar comes from. But the Msasa honey is very, very high in fructose and has very little glucose. And that honey does not crystallize because fructose doesn't crystallize very easily. And it's very dark. It looks almost like molasses, which is how I remember the name Msasa. Sounds like molasses. It's dark and it tastes like raisins or prunes. It's really wonderful. It's very different from the honeys that most people are familiar with in the temperate climates. The other one from a tree called Julbernardia paniculata is the Muchesa honey. That one is light in color. It's the opposite. It's among the highest glucose honeys in the world. And so it crystallizes very easily, and it even dries. You can dry it out and almost like a powder form. Wow. And it's got sort of a smoky, complex flavor, and I really like it with sauces or to cook with it because of its really unique flavor.
They always say that it's best to take local honey when you're eating because of the local medicinal properties. Have you seen the people use that with these two different types of honeys?
They do have different uses for the two types of honey, but the main use that they have for honey is making beer, which they enjoy. And they use both types of honey for that.
That's great.
And then I've read some research that the local aspect was a theory that related to the pollen, that it helps to suppress allergies.
Yes.
But it seems to actually be the case that what's more important than the honey even being local is that it's raw.
Yes.
The minute that the honey's heated, the enzymes and many of the other properties of the honey are changed and destroyed. So try and get that raw honey.
Yes, absolutely. Andre, with your brand Zambezi, you've created so many products from the bees' hard work, and it really enhances what goes on in the area of Zambezi, doesn't it?
We have soaps made with honey and beeswax. We have lip balm and skin products, some of which have sunscreen, and all of which have really delightful fragrances, using essential oils that we produce in Zambia, sometimes from native plants that are not known to the essential oil trade. So we have some really unique fragrances and properties to those
yes.
products.
And I know lemongrass is a favorite flavor of your lip balm product. Could you tell about that crop, and is it also locally sourced?
So, yeah, there's a lemongrass species that's native to the Kalahari Sands region of Zambia, and it's a much smaller plant than the Cymbopogon citrata, which is the Indian lemongrass. But it has a quite similar and delightful kind of gingery fragrance to it.
Nice.
It also flowers, which is unique. The lemongrass that we are more familiar with rarely, if ever, flowers. But this African lemongrass does flower and produces a different fragrance, which we currently haven't used in any of our products, but it's a really unique, it's a different plant. But it's in the same family, these bunching root grasses.
So you don't use that lemongrass in your lip balm then, or?
We do.
Oh, I thought you just said you
do. But we don't. Oh, the flower, the essential oil from the flower we don't use. That's only available in a certain season of the year, mm-hmm. whereas you can extract the regular essential oil from the leaf of the grass at any time of year.
Got it. And how do you work with keeping the soil healthy?
Well, essential oils are great crops for soil fertility because the amount of material that you remove from the field is very, very low. So when you cut, for example, a lemongrass crop to extract the essential oils, once you've distilled and removed the essential oils, you still have all that leaf matter and all that plant matter that you can then take back and return back to the surface of the soil in the form of mulch. And that mulch over time breaks down, it shades the surface of the soil, and it improves the fertility of the soil over time in a really great cycle of nutrients. And only the essential oils are taken away, which are just a few pounds, 20 to 50 pounds per acre of material is actually removed. So almost every other crop, you'd be removing tons of carbon from the surface of the soil. And I think that's also significant because we don't really want to be shipping massive tonnage from across the world. If we can do it in a different way, that would be better. If we can produce things more locally, that would be better. But because of climate, we can't produce all of these products locally in the United States. Like, we don't have the right climate to grow lemongrass here.
Right. So do you do all of the production in Zambia and then ship the product?
In some cases, we do that. And in other cases, because of the difficulty of getting appropriate packaging in Africa, we do the final filling step here. But our goal as a company is to employ as many people within the continent as possible as they climb the value chain ladder and are doing more of the value addition themselves. Traditionally, under the colonial system, Africa was seen as a source of raw materials, and we want to change that script and see Africa as a source of really high quality, not only packaged goods, but also brands that can represent the traditional plant knowledge and the richness of their cultural and botanical heritage and retain more of that value for their own communities rather than seeing that leave the community in the form of a raw material and all the value kind of go to brands that are owned abroad.
And what is your biggest challenge in cultivating environmental stewardship in Zambia?
I think our biggest challenge is the colonial legacy that is left behind. We have a whole host of issues that come from that. The perspective that people have been taught that they are poor and that they're incapable is something we run into, but also just economic structures, shipping, the way that it works, taxation, all of those kinds of challenges. There are very few exporters of packaged goods from sub-Saharan Africa, and we run into all kinds of barriers, including the shipping. It takes sometimes 4 or 5 months for a shipping container to reach here, and it costs 10 times more to ship it from Africa than it does to ship it from China. And so that challenge is really direct, and it's expensive, and it's a choice that we have to make to produce in Africa rather than to try to do it in a place that has a lower cost transportation system.
Right. And so do you feel like your organization for shipping and branding and all of that is your greatest contribution in helping the local Zambians get going?
Yes. You know, Africans have incredible potential, and they don't really need handouts, in my opinion. They don't really need to be trained or taught or patronized. What they really need is partnership. They need people who can raise capital for them. They need people who can help to brand and market the great things that they're already doing. So I didn't teach anyone to keep bees. I learned beekeeping in a deeper way from their communities and from their history and the way that they do things. But all I really did was come in and connect the dots and partner with them to recognize the great things that they're capable of doing and just tell their story on this side.
Yes. Now, is there something else from the culture and spirit of Zambia that is leaving its mark on you?
Absolutely. You know, the optimism, the perseverance, the persistence, and the community spirit. We have a side project that we like to accomplish of building a free university in a regenerative farm setting in very rural Africa. And the name of the university is Tembo Falls. And Tembo Falls is a beautiful story. Tembo means elephant. It's a story about a hunter who goes out to hunt. And nobody would ever think of trying to hunt an elephant. But this hunter just happens to come across two elephants that are fighting. And one of them mortally wounds the other one with his tusks, and that elephant falls. And so just by a stroke of being in the right place at the right time, this hunter has this great resource of this meat from this recently killed elephant. And so when the elephant falls, the hunter quickly realizes that he doesn't have the ability to make use of all this meat. Like, the resource is just too great. It's going to spoil before he has a chance to process it all and to transport it back and to consume it. And so he realizes that he needs his community to make best use of the resource that he has. So he runs back to his community and he tells everyone, an elephant has fallen. We have gotten an elephant. Come and help us bring the meat back to the community. And so people run out with their baskets and their knives and they begin the work of processing this elephant. And then the guy changes his story and he starts to say, my elephant will really make me a rich man, and my elephant's going to support all of you. You'll all become my workers, and I'm the new chief of the village. And people just sort of sadly pick up their tools and their baskets and they leave, and they say, well, we thought it was our elephant that fell, but now you say it's your elephant that fell. And that's just their recognition that people have to work together and to share in the resource that nature has given them. And really seeing that in action means that it's a lot easier with our Western perspective for one person to kind of pile up a giant pile of money and sit on top of it as this, like, great king.
Right.
With all these resources. But in their perspective, that money flows out widely to the whole community where they haven't been sort of poisoned with this colonial ethic of accumulation of endless wealth. What they do is they share, and the community benefits gradually with the growth of their capability and enjoyment of nature.
What a great story. I just love the philanthropic attitude of all of the guests that come on Cultivated Audio, sharing their knowledge of Regen Ag and wanting that knowledge to be known and used for the world community.
And I just would add, philanthropy means the love of mankind, the love of humankind, philanthropos. And that's not necessarily just about giving things away. And I'll just share this. One of the chiefs that I work with told me that the nonprofits actually are doing business, and the business that they're doing sometimes is trading of honor. And so he says, because we are poor, we have to give you our dignity so that you will give us food. And you use that dignity to make yourselves bigger. And that's sort of the opposite, right? So that's not really philanthropy. That's selfishness. But we can be philanthropic just because we love people and we care about people. And so even if you're doing business, you can be philanthropic by just taking care of and loving other human beings.
Many thanks to Will Winter and to Andre Wasney. I'm Robin Clare at cultivatedaudio.com. And many thanks to all of you for being here and for helping make here where we all want to be.
everything regarding tributaries can be found at tributariesradio.wordpress.com. As we move into 2022, Tributaries is going to air on the 1st and 3rd and 5th Sundays. The cultivated audio shows will be on our website, but will generally not be aired in the Tributaries time slot from here on out. I'm Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.